and I declare the winner of the 2019 Brownlow Medal, Nathan Fife of the Fremantle Football Club.
Shade from the mound. Needs to be in perfect.
Hello all, welcome back to the Centre Square podcast and Sport FM 91.3, your football headquarters. Great to have your company for another weekly episode, our fourth of the isolation series and the fifth of 2020. I'm your co-host, Bray Loveridge, and joining me over the phone this week is Noah Tonkin and Ethan Roth. Boys, how are we?
Yeah, I'm going well. Ethan, how are you?
Yeah, just like yourself, mate, really well. Really looking forward to this episode. You know, no disrespect to any of our past guests. They're always really great. But this guy, I reckon, is probably our best one to date in the history of our episodes. I think Andrew Embley was up there for a bit. But I reckon the guy that I'm about to introduce is probably overtaking him. So I'll introduce him now. Pick 32 in the 2001 AFL draft from the Oakley Chargers. 159 games for Hawthorn, including the 2008 Premiership and 2007 All-Australian. 46 games for Gold Coast, with a total of 205 games, kicking 109 goals. 4 games for Australia in international rules. 1 game for Victoria against the Dream Team in that one-off match in 2008. And has now gone on to be a media personality, covering many big events on Channel 7, 9, Triple M and SEN Radio, just to name a few. It's Campbell Brown, who's been good enough to take our call over there in Melbourne. Campbell, thanks for being a part of the show.
Yeah, going well. Thanks.
Much appreciated. How are you?
That's a big wrap. Embers is a Norm Smith medalist, so yeah, I never got one of those.
Pretty close.
So before we get into your career and journey, just with everything that's going on at the moment, you're obviously in media yourself and have been for a few years before. After your playing day, what is your take on the current state of where everything is at, and when would you expect to return to footy, and what is the best concept or way?
Yeah, it's strange times, isn't it? Unprecedented, really. You know, no one, even 6 to 8 weeks ago, could really anticipate just what was going to unfold. I thought the AFL did a great job getting round one away, and I think deep down they probably knew that there wasn't ever realistically going to be a round two, but it was just important to start the season while they could. And I don't think there's a definitive date yet that we'll see the game back. They're sort of talking by the start of July. Realistically, I think it's going to be in July in some time, and whether we're going to see hubs or not, I'm not too sure. It's a pretty evolving situation. You obviously would have heard about the players that weren't too happy with one of the proposals that the AFL put forward. That's not the only proposal that they put forward to the players and the Players Association. It was one of them. It was probably the most extreme, the 20-week hub, no family. But certainly caused a bit of backlash amongst the playing group. I think we'll get a season away. I'm pretty confident we will. Probably without any spectators until November or December. But that could obviously change at any moment with an outbreak or something like that. But the AFL and you know, the broadcasters and the majority of the players are hell-bent on you know, getting a season away and what that looks like. We're not too sure, but looking forward to it, just like you boys.
Of course. First off, can you tell us about your early days growing up and the impact your father had on you from a young age? We believe he's a Sandover medalist over here in Perth. Do you think that's where you got your hard, aggressive playing style from?
Yeah, probably. I grew up in a footy family. Yeah, everyone in my family loved football, but obviously the old man had played and is a bit of a West Australian legend over there. And he certainly encouraged me to play football. I loved it from a young age anyway. I think I remember people asking me what I wanted to do when I grew up at sort of 10 and 11 years of age. And my response to that would be, I want to be an AFL footballer. So it was always something I dreamed about doing. But the only problem for me was that I wasn't a super gifted junior. I showed a bit of potential under 12s, 13s and 14s. And then, I matured at quite a late stage. So in those formative years of 15, 16, 17, there's some guys that mature early and pretty big and strong. And I certainly wasn't one of those. So my football went backwards a little bit. I was always pretty small and skinny. And the knock on my game as a junior was I wasn't a great kick and I was perceived to be lacking speed. So had to work pretty hard on those deficiencies, as you do. And got a sprint coach, Bowden Babichek was his name, who was the Hawthorn fitness guy at the time. And every week after school on a Tuesday, I'd go down to Glenfrey Oval and train with him. And that's probably where my affiliation came with the Hawthorn Footy Club. He got my speed up to a level that, was pretty good in the end. And I had a breakout under 18 state carnival. And that probably put me in the mix to get drafted. But up until then, I was just a kid that wanted to get drafted, but probably, from the scouts, was probably not going to. And I had a pretty good carnival playing for Vic Metro. I played on Ashley Sampey and Gary Ablett Jr. as just a negating defender and tried to terrorise them and did an okay job. And from that, Hawthorn must have impressed John Turnbull and the Hawthorn recruiters enough that Hawthorn picked me, pick 32, 2000.
Yeah, cool. You did just briefly touch on it, but moving up the ranks for the Oakley Chargers, did you know you were going to get drafted on draft night? And what was it like being in the same year as Hodge, Judd, Bartel and Del Santo, just to name a few?
Hawthorn had committed to take me. Initially, they were pretty keen to use a third round draft pick. They'd pick 48, but I sort of got a bit of a whisper that Essendon might have picked me before that, so they bumped me down to 32 and they'd made a commitment to me that they'd draft me. So going into the draft, I did know I was going to go to the Hawks, which was pretty handy because I just lived up the road. I only lived a couple of k's from Glenfrey Oval and had been going down there to do that sprint work with Bowden Babichek. So I knew a couple of the young guys that were down there that I'd done some work with. At the time, we didn't know it was going to turn out to be the super draft it was. Hodgie went pick number one and Hawthorn also picked up Rick Ladson and Sam Mitchell with pick 36 and turned out to be a pretty good draft for Hawthorn. And it's a freaky draft. Looking back at some of the players, Dane Swan and Stevie J and Jimmy Bartel, and the list goes on and on all the way up to about pick 80. I think Brian Lake was in the 70s or 80s, and most players in that draft went on to have pretty good careers.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, one could of you the give us an insight so into far, your time early days at Hawthorn and what that was like in your first couple of years?
Yeah, it was pretty tough. We were a club at the time that had expectations of playing finals and not being too far away from potentially winning a flag. They'd lost to Western in a preliminary final by under a kick in 2001. So when I got there in 2002. Most of the footy world externally and certainly we internally thought that we weren't too far away. And Peter Schwab was the coach at the time, missed the finals in 2002. We finished ninth, which was a bit of a kick in the guts. And the following year, 2003, we thought we'd make amends and missed the finals again, finished ninth. And then I remember Schwabe coming out in the Hawks season launch at the start of 2004, and he made a pretty bold declaration that he thought that that would be the year that Hawthorn, you know, after two poor years, go on and win the premiership. And that certainly wasn't the case, because we had a really poor year. We finished 15th on the ladder. I think we only won five games, and Schwabe got sacked after about round 18. So it's fair to say that the first 3 years at the club, you know, we didn't taste much success. Some of the senior players weren't overly happy with how things were going, and changes were made. And that's when the club went and appointed Alistair Clarkson, and the rest is history.
Yeah, so I think what comes to mind when people think about the Hawks is the talent. So people like Roughhead and Franklin, who were drafted not too much younger than you. Tell us about them, as well as the culture down at the club. What did Alistair Clarkson bring to the group and expect from his players?
Yeah, it was a big cultural shift once he took over as senior coach. We probably were not as professional as we needed to be in the first few years collectively. He sort of came in and was very black and white with his approach. You know, if you were late or you missed a massage or a physio appointment or whatever, there's a famous stories that the whole group would have to go down on our day off, which was quite often a Thursday, to St Kilda and jump off the pier and swim in freezing cold water. And basically we did that every single time someone messed up, no matter how big or small it was. And what he was trying to do was get more buy-in from the group to take more responsibility amongst one another. We flew to Kokoda and walked the Kokoda track, which was pretty significant. And what we saw and did over there very much became part of Hawthorn's culture going forward. And just a really strong game plan, structure, and he simplified sort of the way in which he wanted each individual player to play the game. You always knew exactly what your role was going into the game week to week. And with that came more structure, and gradually with the inclusion of Roughhead and Lewis and Buddy and some of those guys like you mentioned, we started to get moving pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah, and are you surprised Clarkson's still there? I mean, when you left in 2010, would you expect him to be still coaching 10 years later?
I look at Clarko as being arguably the greatest coach of the modern era. You know, you just need to look at the coaches that have been at Hawthorn and then gone on to their own success with Damien Hardwick and Chris Fagan, Luke Beveridge, Adam Simpson. There's just Brett Ratton now. There's just an endless list of guys that go there. They learn under him and they evolve and then they go off and have success in their own rights. And he's just been unbelievable with the way that he's been able to sort of get different groups. Because the side that won the 08 flag was very different to the sides that won sort of 2013, 14 and 15. And he's trying to evolve that group again for another tilde with, you know, Sicily and some of the new young guys coming through. So he's pretty innovative with his knowledge of the game. He's a great man manager. He knows how to get the best out of his playing group. And I think he'll be a senior coach in the AFL, whether that's at Hawthorn or elsewhere, for as long as he wants.
Yeah, no doubt. You tell us about the infamous line in the sand game with Essendon in 2004, and as well as your rivalry with Matthew Lloyd.
Yeah, it's, I get asked about that game probably the most of any of them. It was a funny one because it was just a normal Saturday afternoon at the G, Hawthorn Essendon game, and we had lost to Essendon for about 8 years straight. Before I got there, and then before I was there, we'd never beaten them. And they had a pretty tough, strong, physically intimidating bunch of players, Mark and Jason Johnson and Solomon and Barnard and all those sort of guys that didn't mind a scrap. And You could probably look at Hawthorn in the early 2000s and with a tipped blonde hair and Men for All Seasons calendars that we used to do as the complete opposite. We were probably known as the pretty boys of the competition. So Essendon were just beating us again. And right on half-time, Mark Johnson, he tackled, he wrapped up Rob Campbell, our ruckman, and the umpire blew the whistle for a ball up, but he continued on with his tackle and drove him into the ground. And, you know, it'd probably be called a dump tackle these days and you might get reported. But back then in 2004, there wasn't too much wrong with it. And Hawthorn players just stood there and copped it. And Robbie, you know, was pretty slow to get up and it was clearly affected by the tackle. And no teammate remonstrated or did anything. And then the siren went at halftime. And so obviously the coaching box saw that, and once they come into the rooms at halftime, they were absolutely breathing fire. And Peter Schwab's always been a pretty reserved guy. He didn't raise his voice too much, but he was livid. Donald McDonald, our assistant coach, was irate. Not long after that, Dermot Brereton came down into the rooms as a director of the footy club, and it's quite rare to see directors in the rooms at halftime. You see them there before the game or after, but very rarely come in at halftime. So he was winding a few players up and basically grabbed a few of the guys, Richie Vandenberg, Nathan Thompson, myself, and said, when are you bikes going to stand up for yourself? You know, how long are you going to let Essendon do this? It's embarrassing. We're sitting in the grandstand as former players, embarrassed by, you know, what this footy club represents now. And we went out there after halftime to prove a bit of a point and to give back to Essendon as much as we got, not really anticipating that the game would evolve into such a massive melee, but that's how it evolved. And Richie Vandenberg and a few of the boys went nuts, and that's how the line in the sand game ended up sort of taking off, and it's become a pretty famous game. It's probably the last wild fight that the AFL's had, and we copped about $90,000 worth of fines, and I got 4 weeks and Vander's got six, and they certainly did miss us, the tribunal.
Yeah, probably one of the games that people will remember forever, that's for sure.
You know, Hawthorn and Essendon always had that rivalry through the 80s, and it had probably fizzled out a little bit up until that moment, and then all of a sudden it sparked back up again. And after that, the Hawthorn-Essendon rivalry was very much real, and we hated them. We loved playing against them, and we started to beat them, which was unusual for us as Hawthorn players. And then obviously it blew up again when Lloydie came off the line and got Brad Sewell. But they were great games. You always look forward to playing, you know, Essendon, and you always look forward to playing against Geelong. They were the two in the fixture that you really enjoyed.
Yep. So a few more years passed by after that infamous line in the sand game, and after not getting much team success. How rewarding was that All Australian jumper in 2007 for you as an individual?
Oh yeah, it was from a personal note. Obviously, winning the flag was the highlight because that's what you strive to do. But being an All Australian was you know, unbelievable reward. It sort of came out of the blue because I was just a rebounding defender in 2005 and 6, and you know, trying to do my best work on sort of the smaller forwards of the game. And Clarko came to me in about round 2 or 3, and Scotty Lucas had just kicked 8 goals, I think, the week before, and he came up to me on the Wednesday at training. He said, mate, how would you like to play centre half back and play on Scotty Lucas? And I was like, you're kidding me, right? Like, he's probably got 18-20 centimetres on me, you know. And he goes, no, I'm deadly serious. I think you can do it with your leg speed and your vertical leap and stuff, and that's your job. And as a player, I loved the challenge of getting a big job, and so that basically started my centre-half back career. And then, you know, we won that game and I played okay. And then the next week we flew to Perth to play Fremantle, and he came up to me on the Wednesday and said, "Well, you've got Pav." And, you know, I was like, "Oh, surely he's taking the piss." Like, that was just a one-off, right? And that had Pav, and we won the game, and I did okay. And next week I had Rewalt, and it just evolved from for me to lock down, you know, the key forwards of the game. And from a personal point of view, I went through the whole year without getting any injuries or no niggles or, you know, anything like that, which is pretty rare, you know, and could train properly, and each week got a job, and Hawthorn played okay. I think a lot of those individual awards, you need a little bit of team success, and because Hawthorn had been the big improver in 07, you know, a lot of the footy media were looking at reasons why, and they probably come up with one of the reasons was I was playing centre half back, and got the All Australian. So no, it was a great reward, but I never really looked like getting back to that that level ever again.
No. Yeah, you would have been pretty small, I guess, for a key defender. Because you know, what are you, 179 centimeters? Is that right?
And yeah, like that, that's really small. But a lot of those guys, they were lead up forwards. You know, so if you could just stay with them on the lead, and back then, the AFL hadn't brought in chopping of the arm rules just yet. So that was my sort of go-to. If I couldn't get good purchase on the ball, I just sort of chop their arms, and it wasn't a free kick back then. So once they brought in, you know, a couple of the rule changes like chopping of the arms and stuff, it made my effectiveness as a defender that played on the tall guys a little bit harder to do.
Yeah, because I was doing a bit of research and I saw a video of you trying to give Nick Knapp a bit of a hard time.
Yeah, that was a bit of fun. I think it was his second ever game. Obviously, he'd come into the AFL with huge raps, and Tom Murphy was picking him up in the second half, and it was a really wet night. And I think he kicked a couple of great goals that helped West Coast get across the line. And Clarko sent a message out to me and said, "Mate, go down to fullback and play on Nick Nat, and you know, teach the young fella what the AFL footy is all about, because he's had a really good night." And so I went down there, mate. The game was sort of over, and for the last 10 minutes, I just tried to harass him and pester him and give him a few elbows in the ribs. And the crowd was going off, and he was having a bit of a laugh. And mate, he's so strong. Even though he was 18 years of age, every time he sort of turned around and pushed me, I went flying backwards. which is, yeah, it's pretty funny vision looking back on.
Yeah. So tell us about the 2008 season before the final series. So you finished second on the ladder behind Geelong, who only lost two games for that whole year. What did you put this down to? Was it a good pre-season, the right players coming in their prime at the right time?
Yeah, it's or a multitude anything else of reasons, from, obviously. I guess, you need your finger on. You need to be a pretty fit side. And we had a guy called Andrew Russell, who was the fitness guy at the time. He's now at Carlton, but he's one of the best in the business. Clarko had been working from a football point of view on the full ground press, or the Clarko cluster, as the media called it. So we were starting to pretty much master the 18-man full ground press. And clubs had never seen it before, and they just try as they might, they couldn't work their way through it, and they tried to handball their way through it. They tried to leave some forwards deep in case they got through for an easy goal. They tried to chip their way through it, but they had no answers, and we were doing it pretty well at the time. So that gave us a significant advantage throughout the course of the year. We played Geelong. I reckon we beat Geelong in 2007 and 2006, and then we played them in 2008 and played them at the G on a Friday night. We only lost by 7 points and probably should have won, and it was about round 17. And basically after that, Clarko called a meeting on the Saturday and just said, "Boys, you know, I haven't spoken about this as a senior coach before, because we've just been building." But he goes, I reckon we can beat Geelong. They're the best side in the competition, and we'll probably be playing them in the final at some stage. And I reckon we're good enough. And that's sort of to hear Clarko say that, because he's never really spoken about that at the time, was pretty significant. And sure enough, we went into the finals in pretty good shape. Hodgie had been playing down back for a fair while, and he'd sort of started mastering the role of zoning off and being the general back there. And we beat the Doggies by about 10 goals in the first final, and Buddy kicked 8, had the week off, played St Kilda in the prelim, beat them by probably 10 or 12 goals. So we got to arrest some of our senior players late in the game and sort of take our foot off the pedal a little bit in the second half, which was pretty important, I reckon, and got to the grand final. And, yeah, I mean, the rest is history. Geelong were the better side on the day. They had more clearances inside 50, shots on goal, you name it. Every key stat that you want to win in a game of footy, they beaten us in, except on the scoreboard, and they missed some sitters. And that probably sapped a little bit of their morale, and it gave us a bit of a boost, because every time, you know, Cam Mooney or Brad Ottens missed a certain goal, we were like, wow, you know, we're still in this game. We went in at halftime in front, which was, it still blows my mind a little bit, because they dominated that second quarter so much. And then enter Skewy Jew. We kicked a couple of great goals, and we had players just step up in the right moments and stole a flag. I got no problem sort of saying that we stole that. We probably didn't have any right to win it, but we did win it, and Geelong, let one go.
Yeah, so you guys were massive underdogs, as you pretty much just touched on there. How nerve-wracking was the build-up, as well as playing in front of the big 100,000 screaming fans at the MCG?
Yeah, it was a great week. The club had just told us to enjoy the week. I think there's two ways you can go about it. You can try and fight it, because it's such a different week. There's the Brownlow on the Monday night. There's the parade on the Friday. There's just a few things that you don't usually like to do, and most players love routine. So week to week, you like to do the same thing at the same time. And grand final week, you simply can't, because it's just such a different week. And so I reckon you can either fight it, which would just take up energy, and it's probably not what you want to do, or you can embrace it and really enjoy it. And we did that as a young group. And then going into the game, we were very confident we had Geelong's measure if we could bring intensity. They like to just handball the ball and ping it around down back from one player to the other and bring it through the corridor and get it in nice and deep to their forwards. And as a forward that day, you always felt like you're in the game if you're prepared to work hard defensively and tackle and chase and just do all that sort of stuff. Then Geelong gave you an opportunity to turn the ball over, and if you could turn the ball over, you could create something in your forward half. And if you go back and watch that game, the amount of goals that we just created out of nothing by Michael Osborne or Mark Williams or Cyril or someone just getting a fingernail in, getting a spoil in, and guys were kicking goals because of it. And that was just the message Clarko sort of said at the start of the game about the shark. He drew a shark on the whiteboard and basically said, Geelong are like a shark. Sharks, if they're moving forward, they get oxygen in their gills, in the water. And if you can stop a shark, if you can catch it in a net or stop it from going forward, it can't get the oxygen in its gills and eventually dies. And so we were like, he comes up with all these analogies, and it was a new one for us. We got the point, and we had a bit of a laugh about it, at his poor drawing of the shark on the whiteboard. But we knew what he meant, and he just meant if you bring intensity on the ball carrier, you're in this contest.
Yeah, you did briefly touch on it, but was there any definitive moment when you realised you were home And could you talk us through the celebrations after the grand final and that night and the days to follow?
Big celebrations, that's for sure. We knew how to party back in those days. Went for 2.5 weeks because we went to Hong Kong on the footy trip not long after that. So big week. But now I reckon once Rick Ladson went back and kicked the goal, I think there was about 8 minutes left on the clock and it made the margin nearly 5 goals.
Yeah.
I thought, yeah, we've won it here, and you keep playing the game out until the final siren. And once that siren sort of sounded, you're overcome with emotion a little bit. I was, because it had been something I'd dreamed of doing since I was a little kid, but you probably don't ever think you're going to achieve it. And the fact that, you know, we got into the grand final, were massive underdogs. Geelong had won the year before and they dropped one game for the year. No one really gave us a chance. And you see guys like Shane Crawford that, you know, 17 years, 305 games for Hawthorn, and his emotion, you know, some of the older guys, it's just a great feeling. It's one you can't replicate, but certainly the days and the weeks after it were good fun, boys. I can promise you that.
Yeah, can't even imagine what it would be like. So you also played in the Victoria vs Dream Team game in 2008 for the 150th anniversary of the AFL. How special was it to be part of that, as well as some international rules series, EJ Witten Legends game later on? And also, what are your thoughts on people saying it was a premiership hangover in 2009 after failing to make the eight?
I love playing State of Origin footy. My old man Mal was a coach of West Australia. He was a chairman of selectors. He played about 16 games and captained the state. So he was pretty filthy that I chose to play for the Big V, to be honest. But his relationship with Teddy Whitten and Neil Curley and those guys through State of Origin footy was huge. So I always knew just how important State of Origin was. And I understand the concept sort of, it can't be what it was back then. But I was rapt to get the opportunity to play in 2008 and, you know, just line up with and against some of the great players. You know, I was playing down back and Matty Scarlett and Darren Milburn and just some of those guys that you only ever play against, all of a sudden you're playing with. And Jonathan Brown was the skipper, which was, you know, to be led out by Big JB was huge. And it was a very enjoyable experience. I've loved playing in the EJ Witten game. Post footy, you know, I know it's just a little novelty and a bit of a piss take. We, you know, we don't take it too seriously, but raises money and it's important. And as for the premiership hangover, I know that a lot of people immediately hear that word premiership hangover, and the first thing they think about is, oh, they party too hard in the off season. It's not that for me. It's the fact of the matter is, if you're playing a grand final, you're not getting any of your operations to your players done until mid-October. And we had plenty. So all of a sudden, all those guys that have had shoulder, knee, ankle, hip, whatever operations, they're not getting any real work in until after Christmas. So you're significantly set back from a playing fitness point of view. Where Trent Crowe never play again after breaking his foot in that game. We had Shane Crawford retire. So all of a sudden, there's a couple of guys that, you know, were pretty... Stewie Jew never got back to sort of playing the level of footy he did in that grand final. So there's a couple of guys that, you know, either don't come back or aren't back at the same level. And the big one for us was that full ground press that I'd spoke about, how we'd mastered it and we were so good at it. The 18 player sort of Clarko's cluster, every single opposition had the whole summer to go through our game plan forensically and work out exactly what we're doing and how we're doing it, and started to implement it themselves the following year, because a lot of coaches and clubs take bits and pieces from the premiership side from the year before and try and use it. And we came back in 2009 underdone as a group without some key players. No doubt we partied and everything, but that might have been 1%. And then the side started doing the full ground press better than we were. We could do it. So all of a sudden, what was one of our great strengths became a bit of a weakness of ours. And so if all of those things I've just mentioned is 1% or 2% or whatever, in a AFL game of footy, if you're going into a match 4 or 5% off what you were the year before, you're going to lose, and you're going to lose, by a significant margin. And I reckon in 2009 we were just chasing our tail the whole year, just trying to play blokes that weren't fit. The pressure just built and built and built to the point where we ended up missing the final. So it was a big fall from grace. Probably the most recent side that I can think of that's done that has been the Western Bulldogs. They won the flag a few years ago and have never really looked like being the same force again, because the game just evolves so quickly that you can never stay still and just think it'll just happen.
Yeah, especially with all the rule changes they bring in almost every year.
Yeah, well, that's right. One of the things we did in that grand final was rush the so many behinds, because what it did was it took the ball from being in play. You step across, rush the ball, and then you can give the ball straight to Luke Hodge, Grant Birchall, Brent Guerra, a really good kick under no pressure. Yep. Because they're standing in the goal square. Well, the AFL brought in a rule change, which I loved. I thought it was a great rule change to bring in. But there's another little advantage that we had and used that got taken away from us. So all those things sort of evolve into what people describe as a premiership hangover. And it's probably not just one thing. It's a multitude of all those things I just mentioned.
Yeah. And the end of 2010 comes, you lose an elimination final to Fremantle, and then you sign with the new Gold Coast Suns. What was behind this, and how hard was it to leave home and start fresh at a new club?
Yeah, it's a really tough decision. I'd been wrestling with it right throughout the 2010 season, and it was a pretty easy one in the end. My sort of role within the side had gone from being one of key member in 07, 08 and 09. And with those rule changes, chopping of the arms and a few things, I went from being a defender to a forward. Clarko was using me as a defensive forward. And sometimes I'd sort of just come off the bench and just plug a hole back or forward wherever I was needed. And while, being a utility and a team play, you don't mind what your role is or where you play. I could just sort of read the tea leaves a little bit, that my spot in the side, while it was secure in 2010, and maybe for some of 2011, it was going to be diminished pretty quickly. And we had Ben Stratton, Paul Pioppolo, Isaac Smith, Taylor Gerade, Luke Bruce, all these guys at the club coming through the ranks. And you could see, by watching Box Hill or whatever, that they were going to be pretty good players. And I had the offer from the Gold Coast. It was a 3-year deal, leadership role, better money, but also more opportunity post the 3 years that with a young group up there, you might be able to extend it for a fourth or a fifth. And then I was talking to Hawthorn, and they were not budging on a 2-year deal, and pretty much saying, well, at the end of that 2 years, that's probably more than likely going to be it. I was 27 at the time. So from a business decision, I loved Hawthorn. I grew up in Hawthorn, got a lot of good mates there. But from a business decision, I was thinking, righto, do I sign a 2-year deal at the Hawks and be retired at 29? Or do I go up to the Gold Coast, start at this new franchise, test myself a little bit up there, because it's going to be a different environment. Play till I'm 30. Maybe if the body holds up and the form's good, you might get a fourth or fifth year out. It was a bit of a no-brainer in the end. So that was the decision that I made. And it was an interesting one because it was much harder than I thought it was going to be up there to it was very different than Gold Coast.
What were some of the challenges of joining the Suns with such a young list coming from a successful side in Hawthorn? And was there any ways that experienced players such as you and Gary Ablett tried to help the younger players at the Suns?
Yeah, a normal footy club, you've probably got 38 older guys. When I say older, sort of 20 to 30 plus. And every year you draft, you know, seven. So there's a lot of guys around these young players to sort of indoctrinate them into a footy club and show them the ropes and teach them about professionalism and, you know, all that sort of stuff. Well, up on the Gold Coast, they were allowed an extended playing list. So there was like 50 young guys. I'm talking sort of 17, 18, 19-year-olds. And about six of us senior guys. So, like, the roles were sort of reversed in a way. And it was just really hard day-to-day, week-to-week, especially on the training track, trying to teach these young guys, the patterns to run and the little one percenters of body work and stoppages and this and that. You try as much as you could, but the sheer weight of numbers was just too much. And they were having to learn from the most basic of things, diet and things like that, hydration, all that sort of stuff, as a 27, 28-year-old, you forget that you went through that back in the day. It was a really tough time trying to get this group and not know how hard you could push them training-wise. I'm sure Guy McKenna was wanting to get games into them as much as he could, but a lot of them would pull up sore, so you couldn't train them during the week, which meant that we couldn't do much ball work during the week and coming out on weekends and playing. And game plan structure, all that sort of stuff was minimal in the first couple of years, which made it hard because some of the basic understandings of the game weren't getting through. It was just tough. The first year was exciting because everything was new. First game, first win, opening of Metricon Stadium, all that sort of stuff. But certainly years two and three, I was getting quite frustrated with just the way that it was going. And you could probably tell by the way I was playing week to week that I was starting to get frustrated because I was trying to take it out on the opposition a bit. They've got things wrong. There's no doubt about that. Quite a lot of things wrong. And that's probably why the club hasn't gone on to be anywhere near as successful as it should. And also as the GWS Giants.
Yeah, you mentioned that word frustrated. How frustrating personally was that 2011 season? You got suspended early on for 4 weeks and then you injured your pelvis against Geelong to end your year, and then you also got removed from the leadership group later on.
A lot of it brought upon by myself, so I've only got myself to blame. The suspension in the second game was just, elbowing Callum Ward was just silly. Copped a couple of weeks for that. I thought that I tried to put a bump on Barry Hall and just mistimed the bump, like marginally. Got him a little bit high. I thought I was going to get cleared for that. They gave me another 2 weeks. I ended up getting 4 weeks, which was frustrating because as a senior guy, you wanted to be out there every week for the Suns because they just didn't have much experience out there. So you felt like you were sort of letting the boys and the club down a bit. Breaking the pelvis was just a weird one. I've had some injuries before, but geez, that was painful. I just tackled James Kelly front on, and his knee just hit me right in the left sort of pelvis area. I got a free kick for holding the ball, so I got up to kick the ball. I was like, oh, that's just a massive corky. And, you try and run it out a bit. And And so I was just trotting along. It was getting sore and sore. And then I went to sprint and I just felt a massive crack. And my leg just gave way and I collapsed onto the ground. And I didn't really know exactly what had happened. It's like a sniper had shot me. But the pain was immediate. I couldn't lift my leg. And they stretched me off, took me to Geelong Hospital. And, yeah, sure enough, I had a clean break right through through the pelvis, which was a rare footy injury. It's like you see when a pedestrian gets hit by a car. But it healed fine and I had no problem with it with the rest of my career. But that was it was a weird one. Yeah, that's for sure. So, no, 2011 was a challenging year on a lot of fronts.
Yeah.
Yeah. In 2013, your time was finally up after an incident with Stephen May. How disappointing was this as you were only 29 or 30 at the time? And did you feel like you had plenty more to offer?
Yeah, I just turned 30. I just signed a new one-year deal with the Suns. My footy in 2013 was very, very good. I got suspended a couple of times. I missed the first 6 weeks of the season. Came back in round 7, immediately sort of made an impact, started kicking goals. And then late in the year, again, I think there was probably 3 games left. I got rubbed out again. Otherwise, I probably would have won the goal kicking for the Suns that year. I was finding the footy. So I was looking forward to 2014. And just got in that incident with Steve May, got into a blue in LA. That was the end of me. At the time, I didn't know he had a broken jaw. I found that out the next day, and then when I found that out, I was a bit upset because wasn't the intent of what unfolded. Two blokes having a bit of a crack, and the club made their decision to part ways, and I was okay with that. I still thought I had a fair bit to offer, but I can understand the decision behind that. And all of a sudden, it was a couple of weeks before Christmas, and that was it for me. That was the end of my career. So, it was an interesting journey. You learn a lot along the way, a lot of ups and a lot of downs, but probably wouldn't change anything because it makes you the person you are today. And while there's things there that people might say, oh, surely you change that. You got to stick by the decisions you make at the time. And I've never been one to sort of look back and be disappointed with anything. It's sort of you learn, you apologise if you're in the wrong and you move forward. And, I think if you ask me as a 14 or 15 year old that dreamt of playing AFL footy, if you end up saying to me you'll play for 13 years and win a flag and play a couple of hundred games, would you take it? I would say that'd be more than I ever dreamed of. So I was wrapped with my career and would have played a lot more had I not been suspended for 29 weeks.
Yeah, of course. So moving on to the next phase of your life, when did you realise your passion for media and realised it was something you wanted to do? And how did you first get into some TV or radio stuff?
I always enjoyed doing the media and sort of there's a lot of players out there that get asked to do media requests and they knock them back or can't be bothered or just don't feel comfortable because they're afraid they might say the wrong thing or whatever. I was never one of those guys. I always felt, just be true to yourself, say what's on your mind, speak honestly, not in cliches and all that sort of crap. If you feel strongly on a subject or a topic or whatever, say it. So I always sort of enjoyed the media. I wasn't sure whether I'd get into it post footy, especially after the way it sort of ended. But had built some really good relationships throughout the years with, you know, Triple M and Channel 9 and Channel 7 and stuff. And a few opportunities opened up by doing the VFL and doing some special comments and stuff like that. And I've just sort of found since I finished footy, the more you say yes to, the more opportunities you get. You know, sometimes that's working, you know, working for free or things like that, or having a sort of, you know, fly interstate to do a game on short notice or whatever that may be. I just have always been one that you never know what's going to come of it. So my media career to date has a lot of it has just bobbed up without much knowledge of it, and then they just ring and say, oh, by the way, I saw you do this, you did a good job, can you do that? And I just say yes. I think for people that finish footy and just expect that they'll get into the media because they're a good footballer and they think the money's great and these opportunities will just bob up and out of nowhere, they'll be rudely mistaken, because it's not the way it works. And it might be for some superstars in the first 12 months, but after that, you're just another retired footballer, and every year you're out, someone else comes out of the game, and you get pushed further and further down the rung. So, my advice to anyone that wants to get involved in media or sport media, footy media, is just have a crack and do what you boys are doing, do a podcast, have opinions, and you know, just always say yes to whatever opportunity you get thrown at. And there's been guys that have made careers for 20, 30 years in the media just by not having an ego and just, you know, putting that to the side and just doing a job on short notice and just doing it the best they can.
Yeah, indeed, makes sense. So obviously covered a lot of different events such as the Brownlow Red Carpet, Channel 7 pre-game grand final last year, as well as some racing and being on the Full Monty. Is there one event that stands out as your best experience for you, and what is your favourite thing to do, or when do you feel like in your element? So, for example, boundary ride or commentary or on
I
radio?
I definitely feel in my element more when I'm doing special comments of a game, of footy. I love that environment, but it's all fun. I'm probably the least fashion sense person on earth. So how I do the Brownlow Red Carpet is still beyond me, because I've got no idea about any of those dresses and stuff. But that's good fun. That's a little bit more nerve wracking because obviously it's a pretty big audience and things like that. I love doing the Full Monty. That was just a cracking couple of weeks with some guys that, you know, Shane Jacobson and Chris Smith and guys you'd never usually hang out with. But it was very cold that night. I'm pretty sure that they had the bloody air conditioner on just in my part of the stage. It was good fun, and we raised some money for charity. So, I love doing the footy commentary. That'd be my number one. But like I said, I reckon now more than ever, you've got to be multi-talented. You can't just think that you're just going to do one thing. You've got to be able to do more, and the more strings you can add to your bow, the better. So the only work I've got at the moment is racing work, because that's what's horse racing. That's what's going on at the moment. If I didn't have a passion for that, you know, and just relied on football for an income, well, I wouldn't have it at the moment. So I reckon, writing articles I enjoy as well. It's all different, but it's all a bit of fun.
Yeah. Just a quick one. Can you give our viewers or listeners an insight into your daily life with work and what you have to do and what you currently do at the moment as work? Cause you've touched on racing and obviously VFL stuff. So yeah, what do you do at the moment?
Yeah, mate, good question. Not much. I've got a 20-acre horse property in near the Yarra Valley in Victoria, Melbourne. So I've got five or six horses out here that me and my wife look after. Got a little two-year-old son, Boston, who's an absolute lunatic. He takes up plenty of time and energy. And the VFL's been called off this year, so that's not going to be played. But my week is pretty much like everyone else's at the moment, just staying indoors. I try and stay fit and train where I can. I like to sort of pick out a goal each year and train towards that, whether it be a marathon or, you know, climb out Kilimanjaro last year. I've attempted to swim the English Channel. I reckon that motivates me to get out of bed and do things and challenge myself. But yeah, a couple of days work on the horse races, and that's about it for me at the moment. Just
nice. ISO life. Who are the guys from both Hawthorn and Gold Coast that were your best mates during your playing days, and also still that you regularly catch up with? And have you got any funny stories you could give us an insight on from your playing days, or any pranks or anything like that?
My best mates from the Hawks are Brad Sewell and Grant Birchall. I got on really well with Hodgie, being, you know, the same draft. Xavier Ellis, who's doing great things over in Perth at the moment. And then from the Gold Coast, I got on really well with some of the young boys. I sort of took them under my wing. Brandon Matera, Trent McKenzie, Harley Bunnell. I reckon is one of the most talented players I've ever seen. And hopefully he can get his body right and get on the track for Melbourne this year, because I reckon he's still got plenty of good footy left in him. So Michael Riscatelli, Nathan Bock. You make plenty of mates from your footy days. You're not best mates with all of them, obviously. It's like going to school. There's some that you get on better with others. Some you don't get along well with at all. But you've all got that one sort of goal, and that's to play well and play your role. Funny stories. My funniest story of Clarko is one day after we'd lost to Port Adelaide over in Adelaide. In the team meeting, pretty nervous time, 4 o'clock on a Monday afternoon at Waverley, because you're never sure which Clarko you're going to get. There's some days we sort of won by 10 goals and you walk into the theatre pretty confident and happy with how you played, and you just tear shreds off everyone and show all the poor things we did for the day. And then there are other days you sort of lose a game that you should have won, and he'd be super positive. So on this particular occasion, Jay Schultz had kicked 7 goals and we'd lost to Port, who were last on the ladder, and it was just a diabolical loss. He was standing out the front of the group, and we were pretty sure which Clarko we knew we had, because his eyes were darting around the room. He had a bit of spit on the bottom of his lip, and he was irate. And off he went on this tangent about, you know, he didn't think that the players did too much wrong. He actually thought that he'd coached poorly, and he's off on this rant saying, you know, I should have done this, I should have done that, I should have tagged Travis Boak, I should have dropped Hodgie back when they kicked 2 in a row halfway through the third quarter, I should have, you know, moved Stephen Gillam. And he's worked himself up into such a frenzy, and he's looked to his right where there's always been a whiteboard, and for whatever reason it wasn't there that day, and he's looked to his left and there was nothing there. And so he's eyeballed the playing group, and he was just so angry, mad, and he's just punched himself straight in the face. And probably you've heard the full connection.
Oh, no.
And he's still trying to deliver this message, but his knees buckled and he started slurring his words. And I think one of the boys ducked out and grabbed the doctor. And mate, there's a true story about the day that Clarko knocked himself out in the team meeting.
Yeah, I've seen him actually, like, he's punched some stuff in the coach's box, and he also punched, I think it might have been, like, the roof of the dugout as well.
And he's, one time. Mate, he's abused Journo. Like, he's just one of the great moments, and he's just a great guy, and you love his passion. You know, he's a guy that you'd do anything for, because you'd know that he'd do anything for you, and pretty sort of fortunate to have had a playing career that, I got to play under him for 7 years, because, he's one of the greatest of all time, as far as I'm concerned. So you feel fortunate that you not only had the opportunity of playing with guys like Buddy and Hodgie and Mitchell and Gary Ablett and that, but Clarko has had a massive impact on my life and just your moral compass going forward and all that sort of stuff. He's well after you've retired, a lot of the stuff that he taught you as a youngster, you're sort of instilling your day-to-day life. So, he's brilliant.
Yep. Last one before the Q&As. Based on your experience with playing footy, what advice would you give to a young player trying to reach to the next level?
I'd just say the harder you work, the luckier you get. I'm a big believer of that. Nothing happens without sacrifice. And if you want to play AFL footy, especially these days, I know when I played, you could go out and have a few beers and enjoy the social side of things a lot more, whereas probably today it's gone another step further. A lot of guys can't do that anymore. So that would probably require even more sacrifice. But know your strengths and your weaknesses and, work on both of them. A lot of people say you only work on your weaknesses. Well, that's true, but work on your strengths as well, because they're the things that are going to get you drafted, are going to get you games of AFL footy or whatever that may be. So don't neglect them to the detriment of other things. And just everything you do in life, do it 100%. Have a crack. Because you'll never know how far you could have gone if you actually committed everything, and that's something I've sort of lived by. And I would say that on talent, I probably had no right to play AFL footy for 13 years, but I just made sure that every kick I got, every player I played on, I did my best job and left nothing on the table. So, yeah, that's the advice I would give.
Thank you. Thanks to everyone who has sent in the questions. If you haven't or you want to ask a question to a future guest, make sure to go check out the Instagram at Center Square Podcast on Instagram or Facebook to find out when we have guests coming on to ask some questions. But first question is from _ Hawthorne FC and Talking Freo, same question, I believe. How confident were you heading into the 2008 grand final to cause an upset?
We were pretty bullish. We probably had the arrogance of youth. We were a very young side, and going into a grand final that everyone expects a side to win, which was Geelong, it really took the pressure off us as a playing group. We were confident we could knock them off, but it's just amazing going into that game. We were just happy being there and had absolutely no pressure whatsoever externally. Yeah, internally, we had pressure on each other, and Clarko certainly was, making sure we weren't going to waste an opportunity. But we just had a feeling that we matched up well against Geelong, and they always struggled on our small, medium forwards. It was never Ruffy or Buddy that got hold of the Cats in those games. It was always Mark Williams, Michael Osborne. I'd go forward against Geelong quite often, as I did that day. And the small, medium forward, Cyril, that could take a mark and kick a goal, troubled the Cats' defence of Milburn and Harley and Josh Hunt and Scarlett and all those guys. So we were confident. And we were young and arrogant. And
nice. Next question from a member of the podcast, Luca, or at Luca Vinning. Any tips to stay fit during lockdown?
It's a good question. I suppose you just need to. You're allowed to leave the house, so just do whatever training you think you need. At the moment, hating long distance stuff, so I'm just trying to do short sharp runs, but not really doing much weights or sit ups or anything. You could probably tell if you looked at me. I'm I'm starting to get a bit of a dad bod. So I need to take my own advice and start doing more, I think, Luca. But get out there and have a training session and do whatever you want.
Yeah, I think hopefully that's where he is right now because for whatever reason, he couldn't join us today. So hopefully that's a good enough excuse. This next one's from Maverick underscore Tresothic or Liam Buchanan. Was the Lloyd hit off the ball on Brad Sewell the worst we've seen or is there worse?
I've never probably thought about it being the worst or not. I know that in the moment we were pretty fired up. We'd gone in at halftime, nearly 5 goals up, and the winner that day was going to go on and play finals. So there was a fair bit at stake, and we didn't have Buddy or Ruffy or anyone playing that day. So we're very undermanned. And when Lloydie came out and lined up at the edge of the square after halftime, we weren't too sure what he was going to do. But when he hit Sewley, who was the best man on the ground at the time, did a bit of damage. I think he broke his eye socket in 3 or 4 places. And it was a big hit. I know that. I felt it. I was only 5 or 6 metres away. And I actually hurdled over an unconscious Brad Sewell to get into the melee. I've seen that on tape. It's quite funny. I didn't run around him. I jumped straight over the top of him. So big hit. He certainly made a statement, Lloydie, that day, and there's no doubt whatsoever that he helped win him the game of footy. So I suppose he went out with a bang and did what, you know, a captain should do, lead from the front. I think he got 7 weeks for it, so he copped a fair whack. But, it was a big hit. I haven't I saw the Jordan Lewis hit on when Harbrow hit him that day at Marvel Stadium, and it was up there with that. That was probably the biggest I'd seen, but did less damage, believe it or not, because Jordan came back on and played about 20 minutes after that, believe it or not. So,
That hit was huge. But next one from @AFL_2020News. Any regrets you've got from either clubs you've played at during your career? Yeah.
Oh, I sort of touched on it before. Hindsight's a wonderful thing. And, had you told me things were going to pan out the way they did at the Gold Coast, would I still go? Well, you know, how do you know? All you can do is make the best and most informed decision at the time and hope it works out. So there's no regrets there. Certainly, you know, the decision to go to the Gold Coast was a good one from a football perspective. And I played good footy up there, just didn't work out because of a couple of on-field and off-field incidents that were brought on by myself. So, yeah, would have been nice to stay at the Hawks and try and win a second premiership, but I felt like that was probably not realistic for me.
Yeah. And this final one, lucky last, from Noel Johnston and Nolsey, one of our great mates. What are the most memorable or funny moments you've seen from the spectators and cheer squads, either as a child, through your playing career, or now as a commentator?
I always enjoyed when a streaker came on the field. That used to be good fun. Happens less and less now because of the fines. But, look, supporters and cheer squads are what make the game great. They're the ones that slave for hours and hours during the week to make banners that we run through each week. And I wouldn't say they're they're forgotten, because certainly the players absolutely, love what they do for the club. I think we saw in round one this year that, without fans, without supporters and cheer squads and all that sort of stuff, that the game is actually quite boring, I reckon. I watched a lot of the round one games, and it wasn't the same without the supporters. So without the supporters, the game just lacks the passion and the energy and the vibe going forward. So no, we love them, and some can be a bit over passionate sometimes, but it's all good. No one loved getting abused by spectators more than me. I loved it when they started abusing me.
Yeah.
Yeah, and just to finish off on, we have got a bit overboard, but Bray, what was the question you were going to ask? Who would you rather commentate with? Go on.
I was just, because you do a lot of the VFL, I was going to ask who's a better commentator, Jason Bennett or Nigel Carmody?
Oh, they're both fantastic. I couldn't split them, and to be honest with you, both of them could and should be doing more AFL because yeah, they're great with their player identification. They're great with the moments in games. They got a good handle on it. So, yeah, there's plenty more good things to come from those two. I reckon they're both great and can't split them. I know that's I don't like sitting on the fence too often, boys, but I'm sitting right on the fence because I've got to be in between them.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
In the box week to week. We've been doing it for 5 years and we love it. So I'm very fortunate that I can work with two guys I get on so well with.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, that's going to be the end of the show for now. Thanks to Noah and Ethan for joining me once again. And a massive thanks to Campbell for joining us. We've all learned a heap and I'm sure our listeners will as well.
Now, good on you, boys. Thanks for having me. Good luck with your podcast.
Cheers, Campbell.
Try and achieve in the future. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for coming.
No worries. Cheers. Very much appreciated.
Until next time, you've been listening to the Centre Square podcast and Sport FM 91.3, your football headquarters. Hope you've enjoyed the show. Thanks for your company. Stay safe and we'll see you soon.